Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. A huge salvage operation is underway in the Valencia region of eastern Spain following this week's catastrophic flash floods. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, says he's deployed more than 10,000 troops and extra police to help with the recovery and relief efforts.
In total, we're talking about the biggest deployment of emergency services in the army that we've ever deployed in peacetime in our country. This deployment has already carried out 4,800 rescues and helped over 30,000 people, rescuing them from roads, homes and flooded industrial areas. Unfortunately, the scope of this disaster means that this is not enough. We know that aid is taking time to reach certain locations. There are still garages and homes that are blocked, and people are still trapped.
The local authorities in the Valencia region have been criticised for not responding quickly enough to weather warnings of potential large-scale flooding. But local leader Carlos Mathon defended his team's response. He said the emergency services had reacted straight away to the disaster.
A toda esa gente. I want to send a clear message to everyone. We're going to reach all the homes, whatever it takes. We're going to do it. We've been working to achieve it since the first moment of this catastrophe. Since the very first moment, all emergency personnel available were working tirelessly from the very first moment.
Well, 211 people are known to have died, but there are fears that number could rise as the number of people still missing is still unknown. In some good news, though, a woman was rescued from her flooded car. She'd been there for at least 3 days without any assistance or supplies. Thousands of people have been volunteering to help clearing the streets and homes. Others have been collecting clothes and supplies for those made homeless by the floods. One of those volunteering is Inma Albaterte. She's a school teacher.
Everything I'm seeing is just misery from colleagues, from work, people just like me, exactly the same. I mean, people who, well, I could have been affected and I haven't. And they're coming to where I am, the community centre, where I'm helping to get clothes, to get food. People who are owners of businesses, teachers like me, you know, people who are wealthy, let's just say literally. I mean, people who would have never thought they would be asking for clothes. I have to say, so many people are coming to help, students of mine, people of all ages, teenagers, elderly people. Everybody's doing what they can. All women are sitting down making sandwiches. People are classifying clothes. I mean, everybody's doing what they can.
Inma Albaterte, they're one of those volunteering to help. Well, a short time ago, we got through to the BBC's Bethany Bell, who's in Valencia. The pictures look absolutely awful of this disaster. Is it really that bad?
It's worse than the pictures. The extent of the damage is quite staggering in this city and this area, which is well-developed. You see, earlier today I was in an industrial area with a shopping mall. You could see huge damage, mud everywhere. There was a canal with full of cars submerged in the water. You see in certain areas streets where cars have just been piled up in enormous heaps, just pushed there by the force of the water. And the stories that people have been telling me are very, very difficult to listen to in some cases. There was one woman who told me she was in her hometown of Paiporta, which was particularly badly hit. She said when the flood started, her neighbours just told her to run. And she said she started running and the waters followed her really, really fast. And then she managed to get home to safety. But she was there for 3 days without water, electricity or food and was unable to call her relatives to tell them she was safe. And another man told me that his neighbour had just said a baby had been found in a car, dead in a car just outside his house.
Oh, dear me. I mean, these really are terrifying accounts that we've been hearing. We've heard from the central government that thousands of troops are being deployed there to try and help with the rescue effort, because there are still people missing, aren't there? Any updates on that?
Well, there are specialist underwater teams who are searching through underground garages and cellars looking for people who may have been trapped there. And it's we've seen footage of this very difficult and delicate work. And also, we know in some areas as well, volunteers are helping, going from car to car in some of these pileups, marking them to show that they've been checked to see whether there are people still trapped inside. They're using drones, they're using sniffer dogs, and people are still missing. And there are fears that the longer the search efforts go on, the less likely it is that these people will have survived.
We've seen, Bethany, that there seems to be a growing sense of frustration, even anger, about how this has been handled, certainly on the day that the floods happened. And we've seen criticism aimed, I think, at the local government, that there had been these weather warnings of flash flooding and that the weather centres had said that they would be dangerous, but it wasn't till some hours later that many ordinary people were getting the warnings and the alarms to their phones to stay put or to get out of the way of the flooding. What are you hearing on that?
People are very angry. I spoke to one man who said he had been caught in the street outside his house. There was a rushing torrent suddenly appeared. He couldn't get across the street back home to safety. He was only saved. The water rose, he said, up to his neck. It was only when his neighbours managed to get the signal that he was downstairs and they were able to let him in. And then he said sometime later, he got an alert saying there was the potential for flooding. And another man said that his anger was directed at the local authorities because not only did they fail, in his words, to alert people in time, but he said they knew that this was an area prone to flash flooding, but they have not done anything about it over years.
Mm. Clearly, the cleanup operation and the salvage operation is going to take a long time. It's also going to be really expensive, isn't it?
Yes, and the damage to houses, to businesses, to sort of factories is enormous. And people are still only just beginning to come to terms with how much that might be. And, you know, we've seen today thousands of people. I was standing on the edge of one district that's been particularly badly hit here in Valencia. Just a stream of people, volunteers carrying brooms, carrying spades, buckets, queuing up, waiting to cross over the pedestrian bridge into this particularly damaged area, and the police controlling the numbers of people who can actually stand on that bridge at any one time to get there to help. There's an enormous community effort of people wanting to do their best to try and remedy this situation.
That's the BBC's Bethany Bell speaking to us earlier from Valencia. Well, Spain has suffered from too little rain recently, which also means the ground is hard and less able to absorb heavy rainfall. So can arid countries like Spain adapt to deal with such flash flooding more easily? I've been speaking to Jim Hall. He's Professor of Climate and Environmental Risks at the University of Oxford. So why are densely populated urban areas particularly at risk during such floods?
Well, the thing is that they're densely built up, and all of that is solid surfaces like concrete, asphalt, and it means that when the water hits it, it runs off straight away. So if you get rain which is as intense as it has been in Valencia, then it just accumulates in the streets. It very quickly overwhelms the capacity of the drains, and then it rushes through the cities very quickly.
So Valencia is actually probably quite similar to lots of parts of the world that may have similar problems. And I suppose it's a case of trying to slow down the flow of the water or absorb the water. We often hear of these things called sponge cities or settlements. What can you tell us about that?
Hard surfaces, the water runs off very quickly, whereas more permeable surfaces, vegetation, that does slow the rate of runoff a bit. So you can, first of all, stop making matters worse by paving over areas of cities, gardens, areas which are currently green. And then it is possible to reintroduce green areas, areas of water storage, in order to slow up the flow. But to be completely honest, if you get rain as intense as it was in Valencia, even features like that, they're going to fill up and then the water will start rushing off again.
Does a place like that area of Spain have a particular problem? Because it is so arid, and you talk about having greener areas, but in some parts of the world, it's actually not very easy to grow things like grass or even large trees. What would be the way around that?
Wherever you're able to open up spaces in a city and create more storage, it is possible to create some kind of appropriate vegetation. And so even in urban areas, in arid places, for example, in Arizona, they've created some water storage as well. So it's to do with creating vegetation which is appropriate to the local climate.
There have been suggestions that we should start storing water underground, in underground reservoirs, under cities. Would that be a solution?
Yeah, well, you can do some pretty major engineering to store more water. In Kuala Lumpur, there's a big dual carriageway road tunnel, which is used when there's surface water flooding forecast. They actually use it to store water. In Hong Kong, there's an elaborate drainage system which fills up tunnels under a sports ground in the centre of the city. So that can be done, but it's quite expensive engineering.
So what would your advice be then to urban areas like Valencia? Would it be a case of looking at the warning systems and having better preparation in place?
Yeah, there are two things I would emphasise. One is risk assessment, so modelling, looking what might happen in the future, and then, in particular, avoiding new development in those places. And then the second thing is the flood forecasting and warning system, so that one can predict when the rainfall is going to take place and put out warnings and evacuate people. The problem is, with this very intense rainfall, it's difficult to forecast it far in advance, so it's hard to provide people with much in the way of warning.
Professor Jim Hall there from the University of Oxford. Still to come in the programme, we'll be speaking to the actor who plays the Beatles' manager, Brian Epstein, in a new film about his life.
Those boys will be bigger than Elvis.
It was an honour and a privilege. It was also a gift as an actor, as a role, because he's a fascinating man, very complex. So I certainly grew as an actor. I was hugely challenged, and it was quite daunting. And I got to lead a movie for the first time.
More on that coming in about 30 minutes. Our headlines this hour: a number of people have been injured in a strike on a polio vaccine clinic in Gaza City, where parents were bringing their children for the second phase of the vitally needed vaccination. And Lebanon's prime minister has called for an investigation into the kidnapping of a suspected senior Hezbollah official, allegedly by Israeli Navy commandos. More on both those stories later this hour. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. How does China feel about Russia's flourishing relationship with North Korea? More than 10,000 North Korean troops have been sent to Russia, potentially to train and fight in Ukraine. The Pentagon, NATO and Kyiv have all expressed concern about that. But is the move also worrying China? Beijing has long been Pyongyang's most important ally, providing trade, diplomatic support and military aid to Kim Jong-un. But Chinese President Xi Jinping has been frustrated with North Korea and the instability it brings, particularly with its nuclear weapons program and threats to annihilate South Korea. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker took a trip to the border area where China, North Korea and Russia all meet.
Dozens of curious Chinese tourists have travelled hundreds of miles for a chance to see three countries at one time. Here in the northeast, China owns just a sliver of land and is sandwiched between Russia and North Korea. Tour groups huddle together on the top of a 12-storey tower to take photos next to three overlapping flags on the wall. Peering at their Korean neighbours seems to be the main attraction.
North Korea has always been our neighbour, but to be able to see how they live makes me feel how prosperous and strong our country is.
I feel as a Chinese woman, I am very proud. There are no borders among the peoples.
Everybody's good friends.
Yeah.
This view might be overly optimistic. Like the Chinese territory she has travelled to see, Beijing is caught between its neighbours, allies that appear to be spiralling out of its control. Fears of the growing friendship between Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un have peaked in the last few weeks. The US has said it's seen evidence that Pyongyang has sent 3,000 troops to Russia for a possible deployment to Ukraine, claims we put to the Chinese Foreign Ministry.
Now the floor is open to questions.
What is China's reaction to having both its allies and its close neighbours potentially involved in a conflict in Ukraine? And can China really claim that it is absolutely neutral in this war when President Xi stands shoulder to shoulder with President Putin?
On the Ukraine crisis, China's position is constant and clear. That is, that China hopes all parties to de-escalate the situation and promote political settlement.
Back at the border, as tourists photograph the bridge that links Russia and North Korea, the atmosphere is friendly. But this deepening alliance is not in President Xi's best interests. Christopher Green from the International Crisis Group explains.
The Chinese are concerned that Russia might share with North Korea the kind of military technology that could lead to instability on China's northeastern border. And destabilization on some level could even benefit Vladimir Putin in a way it really would not benefit Xi Jinping.
Oh, we're still being followed?
Yeah,
they're still behind us.
Our presence at the border was noticed by the police, and while it seems tourists are welcome, journalists are not.
Yeah, so they've just blocked the road to the port, which is usually a sign that they don't want us to go there. Time to get out.
We were in public areas at all times, and yet the team was stopped, repeatedly questioned, followed, and our footage was deleted. It seems this topic is sensitive to China. Still followed, we head to the airport. Beijing does not want to be seen as part of what some in the West have labelled an axis of evil. If President Xi continues to stand back, he risks an emboldened Kim ramping up tensions further. South Korea is already looking to NATO and the US to intervene. China now seems to be stuck in the middle as Western anxiety grows.
Our China correspondent Laura Bicker with that report. Now, there are just over two full days to go before the US election. Both candidates for president are campaigning hard for those last few undecided votes, and it really might come down to just a few votes in the end. Either way, Kamala Harris has been speaking at a rally in Atlanta, Georgia, in the past couple of hours. She promised to represent all Americans if she wins on Tuesday.
Unlike Donald Trump, I don't believe that people who disagree with me are the enemy. He wants to put them in jail. I will give them a seat at the table. That's what real leaders do. That's what strong leaders do.
Well, meanwhile, Donald Trump has been addressing supporters in Gastonia, North Carolina, where he also had a familiar message.
And I will bring back the American dream. We don't have the American dream. We had it. We had it. You know, we also had energy independence 4 years ago. This is all you need to know. Kamala broke it. She broke it. We will fix it. I will fix it. It'll be fixed very fast. And America will be bigger, better, bolder, richer, safer, and stronger than ever before.
Well, the BBC's John Sudworth has been at the Harris rally in Atlanta, and I asked him if in this final straight, either candidate was changing their tune or saying anything different.
The short answer to that, Rebecca, is no. You're right. This is the final straight. This is, you know, a no-holds-barred effort from both campaigns to reach every single available voter in these key swing states. They were both in Wisconsin yesterday, on Friday. Kamala Harris woke up in Wisconsin, flew down here to Atlanta, Georgia for that rally where you played the clip from. Donald Trump is in North Carolina. They now change places again. He's on his way to Georgia for a rally tomorrow. She headed off from here up to North Carolina. You know, there's no surprise in any of that. As listeners will know, this is an election that will be decided in these seven key swing states. And some would say none more tightly, balanced than Georgia itself. Just a few thousand votes in it last time round when Joe Biden won it. Both candidates fighting very, very hard for every single vote.
John, we know that around 70 million people have already cast their ballots, haven't they, because of the early voting procedures. Is there a sense that there are many people that are still undecided, or is it all going to come down to turnout on the day?
You're right. A lot of people have voted. Some attempts to read sort of advantage in for one or the other of the campaigns in that. If you look at the areas where people have been voting back in 2020, it was, of course, Democratic Party supporters who were more likely to vote by postal ballot. That's certainly been the case again this time. On the other hand, there's been, compared to last time round, a big spike in Republican voters doing the same. Donald Trump this time round has been encouraging them to do that. That's one theory as to why he lost last time against Joe Biden, despite his protestations, is because not enough of his voters did that. He lost in terms of the hope that most people would turn out on the day. That's all baked in. In terms of the undecided, some people suggest, 10-13% of America may still have not yet made up their minds. And that's why we see this going down to the wire with this sort of last-ditch effort right across those swing states.
The BBC's John Sudworth in Atlanta, Georgia. Then there's lots more on the final days of campaigning and all the breakdowns in the swing states on the BBC Live site. Welcome back to NewsHour. One country watching the US election closely is Ukraine. The course of its war with Russia could well be determined by whoever is the next American president, as they get to decide how much military support is given to Ukraine. Our correspondent James Waterhouse sent us this report from the southeastern Zaporizhia region in the small area still under Ukrainian control.
Usually if you heard drones in southeastern Ukraine this close to the front line, you'd be finding cover and possibly saying a little prayer. But this is a fallback position where Ukrainian troops practice with American equipment. We've got drones to the left, we've got some sizable machine guns to the right, and the dial of American interventionism versus isolationism is acutely felt here, as Ukraine continues to mount its defence against Russia's full-scale invasion. Mm-hmm. So Alex gave us a quick demo with this grenade launcher. The guys here are really keen to show the difference Western kit makes, because if they didn't have it, it would be catastrophic for what is a very challenging stretch of the front line here.
If aid decreases or stops completely, the burden will fall on the shoulders of the infantry and other soldiers. Everyone knows that Ukraine cannot deal with it on its own.
Andriy is in charge of his unit's armored vehicles,
and is keeping half an eye on the US election.
Everyone is waiting. When we hear that one candidate who is less willing to help us is leading in the polls, it's upsetting and frustrating. But whatever happens, we are not going anywhere.
In Zaporizhia City, this happens almost every day. A police officer pulls over after a Russian bomb hits nearby.
In the middle of this central reservation in Zaporizhia is a 10-metre-wide crater, and shops behind me are boarding up and sweeping up glass. Because the front line hasn't moved, this is what cities are subjected to: Russian bombs raining down from the sky.
The bomb blasts blew out the windows of Inna's shop.
The store was damaged, but we are not going to stop. Now we are repairing it, and from tomorrow we'll be open again. Of course, we are worried about the US election, because we want to defeat the enemy. We are hoping that the woman will win, Kamala Harris, and that she will support us.
The outcome of the US presidential election could see either Ukraine being given what it needs to hold the line. We could see a demilitarized zone, potentially. Or support could be pulled, allowing the tide of Russian occupation to swallow Zaporizhia and maybe more.
And that was the BBC's James Waterhouse reporting from Zaporizhia in southeastern Ukraine. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Let's get more on that breaking news in the past hour or so now that a number of people, including children, have been injured in a strike on a polio vaccine clinic in Gaza City, where parents had been bringing their children for the second phase of the vitally needed vaccination. The BBC's Joe Inwood spoke to us a short time ago from Jerusalem. So what do we know of the strike, and do we even know for sure who was behind it?
The crucial circumstances here is this is in the middle of a vital World Health Organization polio vaccination campaign, which was launched today and is taking place for 3 days. So you've got lots of parents and their children turning up at health centers, for example, like the Sheikh Radwan Primary Healthcare Center, which is the one that was hit, to get their children vaccinated. Now, this came about, the news of this strike, because Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the head of the World Health Organization, put out a message on social media a couple of hours ago saying that he'd received an extremely concerning report, and these are his words, about a strike on the healthcare center with six people injured, including four children. Now, it was interesting, he was quite careful to say, or to not say, where it had come from, where the strike had originated. He was quite deliberate in his language, but he says World Health Organization team was there just before. I think it is worth pointing out this is an area that's seen very heavy fighting and has been the subject of a very heavy Israeli offensive over recent weeks. But there was supposed to be a humanitarian pause in daylight hours in this area. And so the message from Dr. Tedros was they were very concerned that a violation of that, as he sees it, would jeopardise people coming to get the polio vaccine.
Yes, as you say, which is being seen as crucial, not just for people in the north, but for the whole of the Gaza Strip. Well, there's other breaking news in the past day on your patch, and this is coming from Lebanon. The Prime Minister there has called for an investigation into the kidnapping of a Lebanese citizen by Israeli Navy commandos. Apparently this is in the north of Lebanon. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, so this is some rather dramatic CCTV that has emerged over the last few hours, and it shows a group of armed men, heavily armed men, they look like sort of naval commandos, moving in tactical formation in front of a building, and they've clearly got with them a man who is being kidnapped, abducted, taken away. Depending on different sides, they use different language to describe it, and it has been confirmed by both sides now that this man is a person called Imad Amhaz. Now, he is a naval officer, it seems, but the Israelis have told the BBC that he's a senior Hezbollah commander who was taken away by a naval commando unit for interrogation. As you say, the Lebanese side have said that this man was kidnapped, and indeed Ali Hami, who is a minister in the government associated with Hezbollah, the militant group, has said that he was a naval officer who's been abducted. But clearly, this is a situation where the perspectives of the Israelis and the Lebanese is going to be very, very different. But as you say, it's also going to, it's causing some tension with the Lebanese government. And I think it is always worth pointing out to our listeners that the Lebanese government, the Lebanese state and Hezbollah are separate things. And Israel is in conflict with one, in direct conflict with one, but not with the other.
And just to clarify, the Lebanese government is saying that this chap was part of the Lebanese Navy.
Lebanese Navy, yes, but okay. The Israelis say he also was associated with Hezbollah.
And that was the BBC's Joe Inwood there a short time ago in Jerusalem. UN Summit on Nature and Biodiversity, or COP16, has drawn to a close in Cali in Colombia. A couple of important decisions were reached. A new fund has been created where a share of the profits from products, including things like cosmetics that are developed using genetic data from wildlife, will be funneled back into conservation projects. It's going to be called the Cali Fund. The other breakthrough was that it's been agreed that a permanent consultative body to the UN will be established. This will be drawn from indigenous communities around the world. Cheers erupted as Susanna Mohammed, the president of COP16, announced that decision.
So I'll ask the parties if you are ready to adopt this document. As I see no party asking for the floor, so it is adopted.
Well, earlier I spoke to Mayor Krista Joma, who's from the Sami nomadic community in the far north of Norway. She's also a member of the governing council at the Sami parliament. She gave us her reaction to the creation of a permanent indigenous consultative body for the UN.
I am very glad that the states finally agreed to establish this and are putting forward this work and to ensure that the participation of indigenous peoples is in the biodiversity governance. So this is something we have worked for very long and something the indigenous people has been fighting for. So this is a very good step in actually achieving and acknowledging our contributions to biodiversity governance and including of our traditional knowledge. So yes, this is something to celebrate.
And so what does it mean then for indigenous groups in terms of their ability to influence policy? What perspective do groups such as yours have that might help everybody understand the environment better?
The indigenous peoples are the experts of the land. We have lived on and with the land for centuries and for generations. It's a good step forward and will help to protect that biodiversity, but also safeguarding our distinct rights and the cultural heritage.
And in terms of specifically the issue of biodiversity and fears that we're losing so much of that, have you noticed in your own community, this is in northern Norway, isn't it, in the Arctic really, have you noticed the difference already that some of these changes have had?
Yes, we see the loss of biodiversity and the loss of land and waters. It's happening very fast. And it is connected to new infrastructure and especially constructions of the so-called green energy. And also we see the effects of the climate change already. We see that it's getting more warmer. The weather is more unpredictable. Suddenly it's starting to rain in the middle of the winters and we see new species that comes in our lands and waters.
And so obviously this new grouping involves indigenous groups from all over the world, from really different backgrounds and environments. What do you all have in common and how do you manage to work together?
Even though we come from different parts of the world, we have the common connection to the land and waters, and we know how to manage them in our own homelands. But we also see the same threats, such as climate change and new interests in our land and exploiting. We have a common concern, but we also have the same will to contribute on this level. And I'm very excited to see the work starting, and I think that our contribution is welcomed, but also something we need.
Mayor Kristina Joma there from the Sami nomadic community in the far north of Norway. But does any of what was agreed or even proposed at COP16 actually go far enough? Scientists are warning that 1 million species of animals and plants face extinction, and that we're seeing a rapid decline in species at a rate unprecedented in human history. So why should we all be concerned about biodiversity? I've been speaking to Orla Dwyer. She's a journalist for the Carbon Brief website that focuses on climate science and policy.
Biodiversity, it's essential to the functioning of our very planet. Biodiversity loss and climate change are inherently linked. Nature currently is declining at unprecedented rates. And what countries are trying to do at COP16 is essentially try and reverse this trend. So they agreed 2 years ago in Montreal at the last UN Biodiversity Summit to halt and reverse nature loss by 2030. And what was being discussed at this most recent summit in Cali in Colombia is basically what progress has been made on this over the past 2 years, and also a lot of issues around the finance for biodiversity and how countries are going to reverse this really negative trend that we're seeing in terms of the scale of biodiversity loss.
Were you satisfied with what came out on that score?
Every country in the world had agreed to submit new national biodiversity pledges showing how they would meet these goals for 2030. But actually, only about 22% of countries have submitted these plans as of now.
And presumably, there are no consequences for the countries that haven't submitted those plans.
Yeah, so it was talked about at the COP, and the reasons tended to be either that there was only 2 years to put these plans in place, and so countries said they needed more time, or that they didn't have enough finance.
So we just heard from the representative there from the Sami community in Norway, broadly welcoming this idea of having a permanent consultative group of indigenous people to the UN. Do you welcome that, or is there a danger that it's just another talking shop? Will it actually have any impact on policy?
That is definitely something we've seen NGOs and Indigenous peoples groups celebrate that came out of this, and particularly given that there were outstanding issues on other aspects of the negotiations, but that the Indigenous peoples permanent body was agreed. I think that in itself is a success that they got an agreement on it by the end of the talks.
You mentioned the finance again, and we talked about the Cali Fund. I mean, that sounds quite positive, doesn't it? That some of the profits will be ploughed back into conservation?
Yeah. So these resources that are taken from animals and plants and then used by companies to make vaccines and medicines and things like that, getting an agreement on a way to do that is a pretty big deal of the talks, especially because it could be a big source of money for countries like Brazil and the Democratic Republic of Congo, particularly because what was agreed in the end is that companies like pharmaceutical companies, agribusiness, tech companies and others that benefit from the use of this data should contribute 1% of their profits or 0.1% of their revenues to this Cali fund. That is a significant amount of money. And also that half of this fund is going to be allocated to Indigenous peoples and local communities as well.
Many environmentalists are still critical that this COP didn't go far enough, wasn't ambitious enough. And yet when you hear, as you said there, that only 20% of countries have actually, you know, put forward their plans for stopping the decline in biodiversity, what else could the UN summit do?
A really important thing is going to be figuring out the monitoring framework, which is something that wasn't agreed at the end of these talks. So this would essentially look at ways to make sure that countries are putting in place these targets that they've set for 2030.
So is that target of halting the decline by 2030, is that even realistic at this point?
I think it really depends on who you ask. So we had statements arriving in from WWF, the NGO, after the talks ended abruptly this afternoon, and they were saying that, you know, these targets are in risk.
And that was journalist Orla Dwyer there. She writes for the website Carbon Brief, and she was talking to me about what's been going on this week at COP16, which has come to a close in Colombia. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. There are any number of books, films and documentaries about the Beatles, but how much do we know about the man considered to be the brains behind their brand that launched them to global fame? A new film about their manager, Brian Epstein, is out. It's called Midas Man, and it tells the tale of how he discovered the Beatles in Liverpool's Cavern Club back in the 60s, and his impact on making them the world's, in the words of John Lennon, more famous than Jesus. Well, earlier I spoke to actor Jacob Fortune Lloyd, who plays Brian Epstein in the film.
Those boys will be bigger than Elvis.
The first thing I did as an actor was just sort of watch him. There were a few interviews he did at the time, and he was very fascinating to watch because he was this, you know, very successful, but very young, very ambitious, very bright, but also quite introverted and shy and cautious. So he was an interesting, complex figure from the very beginning.
Yes, and I suppose looking at it in hindsight, from this perspective in the modern world, where, I mean, his sexuality was an issue back in the 60s because it was still illegal, actually, in Britain to be gay. And he also was Jewish as well, which may have made him a little bit of an outsider back in those days in some ways. But looking at it now from a modern perspective, could you see those elements when you look at the footage of him back then?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think he certainly grew up feeling like an outsider. He certainly encountered anti-Semitism in his school days, and he encountered homophobia too. Can you see that in the interviews? You see a guarded and cautious person, and I'm sure part of that was his experience of being an outsider. He went through quite a number of traumatic experiences. So there was, I think, naturally, you would a kind of guardedness, hiding a part of himself.
Mm.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm.
Musically, you can't really dispute the musical ability of the Beatles, but there are so many musical talents that never made it because they didn't have somebody pushing them and getting them in the right places and being the manager behind the scenes. How important was he to the Beatles in making them what they became, do you think?
I think he was crucial. Many people have said we may not have had the Beatles without Brian Epstein. A couple of things I think were really important. One, that he helped them present themselves, famously taught them the bow, but also how to dress. He came from quite a theatrical background. He loved the theatre. He also trained at RADA. So he brought his sort of theatrical flair to them and the way they presented their shows. I think the other thing he did was give them the space to just be artists. He was a manager who took care of everything. He was a perfectionist. He wanted to control everything. And it enabled them to just focus on creating, being kind of wild creative spirits.
It's interesting you say that because we've actually been delving into the archive and we've got a clip now of Paul McCartney, famously, obviously, one of the Beatles, speaking to the BBC in 1982. And that's exactly the story he tells about Brian Epstein smartening up the band, basically. Let's take a listen.
Yes, there was a fellow who had a record shop. His dad owned a record shop. And he'd been asked for a record that we'd made in Hamburg because we backed someone. A fella called Tony Sheridan. It was called Tony Sheridan and the Beat Boys. They didn't like the name Beatles. So the only record was this one, My Bonnie, which a fella went in and asked for it at Brian's record shop, and Brian hadn't heard of it. So he got interested in us. And somebody said, oh, they're just down the road at the Cavern, you know. So he came in one day, looked at us, and apparently thought there was something there, you know. Because we were all leather and sweat at that time. He sort of cleaned up the act a little bit and said, well, you know, we've got to kind of try for London and stuff, so you're going to have to get suits, which no one was very keen to do, but we went that way.
Tided you
so
up.
So Brian was the fella, yeah.
And he got you auditions for record companies, which was the important thing.
Yeah, none of which would be interested in us. Everyone turned us down until he found some mug, called George Martin.
And that was Sir Paul McCartney speaking to the BBC back in 1982. I mean, Jacob, they're so iconic, aren't they? Anyone connected to the Beatles. And I guess it must be quite an intimidating experience to kind of try and recreate that in a filmic fashion now. Did you talk to anyone who was involved back in the 60s?
Yes, I had a great conversation with Frida Kelly, who was Brian's PA in Liverpool and also ran the Beatles fan magazine. I mean, amazingly, she was 17 at the time. It is extraordinary to think how young they all were, Brian being 26, I think, when he started with them. meeting Frida was wonderful because she had many great memories of Brian, and you could see how much she still loved him and respected him, and made it very clear that, you know, when they were in the office, he was called Mr. Brian, and that he was a generous man, but also, you know, there was a status, and that you had to, and he worked hard, and he expected high standards, and so you want to honour the person and the time period properly.
Mm. You spoke earlier about observing him on the archive and seeing that he seemed to be quite guarded and I guess possibly a little bit lonely as well. And then we had this tragedy of the premature death. Can you tell us a little bit about his story?
Yeah, well, when you read his early journal entries as a young man, he does talk quite a lot about feeling lonely and feeling like an outsider, feeling like he doesn't belong, doesn't fit in. And whilst, you know, the synchrony with the Beatles and becoming a music manager really suited him, I don't think that ever really left him.
Mm.
And then, of course, trying to find romantic, secure love at that time was very, very, very difficult.
Mm.
And then, of course, he gets extremely famous and it's hard to trust people. Hard to trust people are in being friends with you for the right reasons. And then, I mean, the last ingredient is that he became very addicted to barbiturates and to amphetamines, you know, to keep him going, and then to get him to sleep, and then getting up in the morning. So at 32, he passed away. He was on the precipice of something, on a threshold. You know, he could have moved past it and found who he really was. Sadly, he couldn't.
Mm. And as an actor, what do you take away from playing a role like this?
Oh, well, it was an honour and a privilege, and it was also a gift as an actor, as a role, because he's a fascinating man, very complex. So I certainly grew as an actor. I was hugely challenged, and it was quite daunting. And I got to lead a movie for the first time in my career, which was a great experience.
Excellent,
Again, a bit daunting, but a great experience.
You're a hard act to follow.
And that was actor Jacob Fortune Lloyd, who plays Brian Epstein in the new film Midas Man, speaking to us earlier. That's it for this edition. Thank you very much for joining us.